Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project, big or small. From top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to That's Politics, where I break down the political news for the intellectual and curious mind. I'm your host, Mackenzie Atkinson, and today we're going to be breaking down the difference between democracy and autocracy. I need to disclose that the line between autocracy and democracy is blurred. The democratic and autocratic system scale is a spectrum. No system is a perfect democracy or a perfect autocracy, but a version of them. Today's episode just aims to describe what an autocracy is and what signs we can look for to see if we are experiencing democratic backsliding, which I'll explain more in depth later in the episode, but I'm assuming you can figure out what it means. I also need to tell you that I took a class on authoritarian regimes in my last semester of college, shout out Dr. Ingrid Bago, so most of my understanding of this topic comes from that class, and I'm sharing things that I learned in that class with you. So when you hear me reference a class throughout this episode, that's what I'm going to be talking about. Let's kick off this discussion by defining what a democracy is so we can understand what a democracy is not. To start the class off, we defined what democracy means. Funny enough, the article we were assigned to get a grasp on this concept is titled What a Democracy Is and Is Not by Felipe Schmitter and Terry Lynn Carl. The article even describes that democracy can mean many things. It says, quote, "There are many types of democracy, and their diverse practices produce a similar varied set of effects," unquote. Now, there are characteristics deemed to be minimal standards for a democracy. Schmitter and Carl referenced Robert Dahl's list of minimal standards in this article. These minimal standards provided by Dahl are 1. Control over government decisions about policy is constitutionally vested in elected officials. 2. Elected officials are chosen in frequent and fairly conducted elections in which coercion is comparatively uncommon. 3. Practically all adults have the right to vote in the election of officials. 4. Practically all adults have the right to run for elected offices in the government. 5. Citizens have a right to express themselves without the danger of severe punishment on political matters broadly defined. 6. Citizens have the right to seek out alternative sources of information. Moreover, alternative sources of information exist and are protected by law. 7. Citizens also have the right to form relatively independent associations or organizations, including independent political parties and interest groups. These criteria mainly describe the abilities of citizens and how they are able to act within their government. Schmitter and Carl add 2 more of their own criteria for minimal democratic standards, and they revolve around official government actions. They add that elected officials should be able to carry out their duties without interference from unelected officials. This is mainly referencing military officials or bureaucrats interfering with official business. The second added criteria is the belief that governments should be able to make decisions for themselves without the constraints of outside actors like other countries through either alliances or other spheres of influence. I think this criteria might be hitting at the influence of other countries on others in forceful and undemocratic manners. I'm thinking of the Belarus-Russian relationship. Elections are the biggest indicator for how democratic a country is. At the minimum, elections must be fair and open. Everyone has a right to run for office unless it is described in the country's establishing document like a constitution, like in the US. Anyone can run for local, state, or federal offices, but only citizens born in the US have the ability to run for president. Schmitter and Carl describe the post-election criteria as elected representatives will not use their, quote, temporary superiority, unquote, to prevent the losers, both individuals and parties, from running in future elections, and in exchange for this, the losers will respect the outcomes of the election and acknowledge that the winners can make impactful and binding decisions for the country. Again, this is an ideal form of democracy. We can see how polarization within a governing body can cause gridlock and nothing ever get done. This can be seen as the losers not acknowledging the winner's ability to make decisions for the country. But the uncertainty of elections and policy is part of democracy. We will never 100% know who will win an election. I've had many conversations with my dad leading up to the 2024 election, and neither of us knew who was going to win. That is a sign of a healthy democracy. But uncertainty can be contained through our system's governing bodies. Not every policy will be adopted without question. There are debates and amendments to legislation before they even pass through the governing bodies. Now, democracies can also have more nuanced defining characteristics. The list from earlier is a bare minimum list. What I'm going to dive into now is a maximalist list. From the Schmitter and Carl article, they list 11 other characteristics of democracy. 1. Consensus on goals of political action may differ among citizens. Not everyone is going to agree. 2. All citizens have the legal ability to participate in politics, but some participate more than others. 3. Elected officials may not weigh the opinion of everyone equally, even if the citizenry should have the ability to express their preferences. 4. Elected officials may not always do what the citizens want for a variety of reasons. It may be for national security, for example. 5. Positions in government may not be allocated based on assembling the most votes. This hints at protecting the minority and avoiding the phenomenon known as tyranny of the majority. 6. The legislation is not the final say-so, and they too can be held accountable for their actions. 7. Political parties, although used to elect officials, do not run the government. They are entities that exist outside the actual governing system. Currently, the Republican Party is the majority in the federal government, but the party is an organization that is not making the decisions. The members that were elected are making the decisions and can go against the party without punishment. 8. There may be political monopolies within a governing system, but they can include both state and private interests. 9. There may or may not be different levels of government through federalism, but power is expected to be dispersed among some regional authorities in some way. 10. The chief executive officer does not have to be one person. It can be a group of people, and they don't necessarily have to be elected by the people and can be appointed by a governing body. And finally, number 11, checks and balances may not be expressed by different branches of government going after each other, but there's still a sense of accountability. Schmitter and Carl say, quote, "No single set of actual institutions, practices, or values embodies democracy," unquote. Countries moving away from autocracy may adopt different combinations of these maximalist characteristics. Now let's get into describing autocracies. There are different types of autocracy, just like there are different types of democracy. The big three are monarchical, military, and personalist regimes. Monarchical regimes are, you guessed it, monarchies with kings and queens. A very prosperous monarchical regime is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The GDP in Saudi Arabia is about 1.086 trillion USD, making it the richest country in the Middle East and North Africa. Military regimes are very unstable regimes. They normally come to power through a coup d'etat where they overthrow, typically very violently, the regime through military intervention. In 2013, Egypt experienced a coup when Army Chief General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, I probably said that wrong, removed President Mohamed Morsi as a result of public protests of Morsi's corruption. It is typical that once the military steps in to remove a democratically elected official, it kicks off a cycle of coups. The University of Illinois has compiled a list of countries that have experienced coups and how many of them they've had. They define total coups in their chart as conspiracy, attempts, and successes. The top five countries are Bolivia, Sudan, Haiti, Argentina, and Venezuela. Bolivia has had a total of 48 coups, with 17 of them being successful. Sudan has had 31 total, with 10 successful. Haiti had 28 total and 17 successful. Argentina has had 25 total coups, with 9 of them being successful. And Venezuela has had 24 total coups and 6 of them were successful. Seeing a trend there? Now, I guess you could call it my favorite type of regime to study, but they are personalist regimes. Personalist regimes are defined by a civilian coming to power and becoming a dictator. Some classic personalist regimes include Saddam Hussein in Iraq in the 90s and 2000s, the Kim dynasty in North Korea, which has been around since 1948, and Vladimir Putin in Russia, who has been consolidating power since 2000. Personalist dictatorial regimes are where we will focus our analysis today. These dictators share similar characteristics. They tend to have very large egos and like seeing positive things about themselves. In the modern technology age, the regime manufactures positive messaging about the dictator through fake social media accounts that push propaganda that supports the dictator's beliefs and paints them as these larger-than-life individuals. Sometimes you'll see photos of Putin riding on the back of a bear shirtless on social media. This imagery is meant to portray Putin as a strong leader. Could these photos be a joke made by some random teenager or AI? Yeah, absolutely. But why would that be the way someone would portray Putin? The dictators are also insecure and paranoid about their position, even if they give off a confident persona. They tend to surround themselves with yes-men that are loyal to them and do not question their motives. It is also common for them to appoint their family members into positions of government. Dictators also emphasize the strength of the executive office. They portray themselves as the only ones that can fix the system, and they actively point the finger at other institutions within the government system as the source of all the people's problems. They create an atmosphere.
Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project. Big or small, from top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year.
Save big money at Menards.
Sphere of terror around their own governments. But these dictators do not want to get rid of all of it because they would lose their sense of legitimacy. Instead, they hollow out the institutions and appoint people that support the regime and do not question orders. Keeping democratic institutions running gives autocracies a claim of democratic, even if it is far from the truth. Speaking of truth, we sort of already touched on propaganda, but autocracies attempt to control or bully the press into submission. This trend of pushing citizens to not believe the press isn't new. In Nazi Germany, they used the term the lying press. In Russia, they call it the firehood of falsehood. These campaigns against journalists aren't just in words alone. Actual punishments have been carried out. The Center for Protecting Journalists tracks all attacks against journalists and highlights statistics about journalists being killed and imprisoned. From 1992 to 2024, 2,259 journalists have been imprisoned across the world. Of those arrests, 1,324 of them were charged for anti-state crimes, 202 were charged with fake news, and 283 were imprisoned in retaliation for their reporting. From 1992 to 2025, 1,694 journalists have been killed. Of the 1,964, 681 of those were killed as a result of crossfire or a dangerous assignment. The other 997 were murdered, and 205 of those murders were allegedly carried out by local government officials. These anti-journalism campaigns have real consequences. It is typical for dictators to point the finger at groups of people, like journalists, and say that they are an infection to the country. But it isn't just professions. It is also ethnic groups, the most horrendous example being the Holocaust. Hitler said that Jews were inferior and that they were tainting the blood of Aryan Germans. Dictators break down communities and turn people against each other. Neighbors were turning on their Jewish neighbors in Nazi Germany. We can even look to the U.S. in the 50s with McCarthyism and the Red Scare. People were suspicious of their neighbors over political ideology. Remember how I said a key defining trait of democracies are free and fair elections? Autocracies have elections too. The difference being the free and fair part. Belarus recently hosted an election. The incumbent, Alexander Lukashenko, quote-unquote won 86.8% of the votes. This election was not uncertain, Lukashenko had been president since 1994 and has rigged the election in his favor ever since. Now, rigged elections may not always be stuffing ballot boxes as a bundle of balloons walks in front of the news camera. It may be intimidation or just lack of coverage of other candidates. In the US, we have FCC regulations about political campaigns. Each candidate has an equal opportunity to appeal to an audience. In autocracies, this doesn't exist. State-run media will only favorably cover the dictator running for re-election. So now I've given you all the characteristics of personalist dictatorships, but how do they come to power? It is fairly normal for dictators to be elected through democratic elections and then slowly break down the system that elected them to secure their power. There is a term I learned in class called co-optation. Every country has an elite class that has a fair amount of control over the way the country operates itself. Normally, they are wealthy politicians or business owners. The securing power process is co-optation. Aspiring dictators have to appeal to the elite class and garner favor from them to enter the political arena to start their campaign for dictatorship. They cozy up to the elites and give them favors or push for funding for a project they want, or they give them tax breaks or turn a blind eye to corrupt business practices. You would think that once a dictator goes full-fledged authoritarian, they'd be done. Nope. It is a continuing balancing game. Most coups originate from the elites, like the military leaders and other elected officials. But autocracy is not a forever thing. Democratization is possible. Normally, it originates from the people. Citizens band together to oppose the dictator, and that can lead to the imprisonment, exile, or even death of the dictator. Mohamed Morsi was imprisoned and sentenced to 20 years of hard labor after the 2013 Egyptian coup. He was convicted of unlawful detention and torture of opposition protesters. Zine El Abidine Ben Ali was the president of Tunisia from 1987 to 2011. He was ousted from power during the Arab Spring and sought refuge in Saudi Arabia, where he spent the rest of his life and ended up dying in 2019. Also during the Arab Spring, Muammar Gaddafi was a dictator in Libya for 42 years when protests sparked up against him. When the protesters overwhelmed Gaddafi's hometown, him and his inner circle attempted to escape. The escape failed, and he was attacked in the streets. It is unclear if he died due to the attack in the streets, shrapnel from a grenade, or from being shot. The process of democratizing after ousting a dictator is a long and difficult one. That's why, at the beginning of the episode, I talked about variations of criteria that could count as a democracy. Partial democracies do exist. The opposite of democratization is democratic backsliding. This is when an established democracy starts acting like an autocracy. This can start in a few ways. Potentially, it could be through attacking the press and cracking down on protests and opposition. It could be through undermining democratic institutions like the court system when they try and stop the executive branch from overstepping. There are claims that the Trump administration has started the spiral of democratic backsliding in the US. So let's take a look at these claims. Throughout this episode, you've probably picked up on some similarities between characteristics of autocracies and things that are currently happening in the US. So let's start from the top. One of Schmitter and Carl's added criteria to Dahl's minimal list of defining democracy was elected officials being able to carry out their duties without the interference from unelected officials. Well, there are a few events that we can look at and see our elected officials, mainly congressional representatives, being blocked in their official duties. Before we dive into these examples, I want to emphasize that elected members of Congress, both senators and representatives, along with their staffs, have the right and authority to enter any federal building as is part of legislative oversight, which is an implied power of the Constitution. This is a form of checks and balances. An example of this can be seen when Congress members tried to enter immigration detention centers. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection website said that members of Congress and their staff are allowed entry into a building. They request a 72-hour notice in advance, but will do what they can to accommodate visits without the 72-hour notice. Congressional staff do require a minimum of 24-hour notice, but not the actual member of Congress. Well, with ICE arrests being the center of attention and many protests taking place all over the country, some representatives have shown up at ICE detention centers demanding to enter the facility as is their right. Delaney Hall, a privately ran ICE detention facility in Newark, New Jersey, has been a hotspot of activity. On May 9th, there were protests outside of the Delaney Hall Detention Center. Several representatives and the Newark Mail, Ross Baraka, were attempting to visit Delaney Hall at the same time of these protests. From my research, it is unclear if the officials were there as participants of the protest or if the two events were just happening at the same time. Either way, Mayor Baraka was arrested and charged with federal trespassing for being in a gated parking lot, and Representative LaMonica McIver, a Democrat from New Jersey, was arrested for allegedly assaulting law enforcement. McIver's three-count indictment charges include forcibly impeding and interfering with federal law enforcement. Baraka's charges were dropped within 10 days of the incident. We are seeing two very different reports about this event from the federal government. Congress is saying that the arrests and the indictment of McIver and Baraka is an attack on the American people. In contrast, the Department of Homeland Security is denouncing the event, saying that these representatives broke the law and should be punished accordingly. But there is more to this story than just that. A New York Times article that was published on June 14th describes the conditions of Delaney Hall as inhumane. There are claims that detainees are given slices of bread as meals, that detainees are sleeping on floors, and that the water from the faucets is scalding hot or foul-tasting, among other claims. When there are claims of poor treatment of detainees, I would assume that my representative would also look into these claims. I think the May 9th incident was the situation of the officials being in the right place at the wrong time, but the principle is still there. The 72-hour request to tour the ICE facilities is a courtesy. The representatives still should be able to enter these facilities, especially if there are claims of mistreatment at any time. Think of when health inspectors show up to restaurants. Sometimes they do random inspections to see the staff in their element. Or what about when CPS shows up to do a wellness check on children and households? Executive functions need to be monitored, especially when they are being carried out by private, for-profit companies. I'm going to now shift the conversation towards analyzing the Trump administration specifically and how they conduct themselves. This is where many people find their bread and butter for claims of democratic backsliding and traits of a wannabe dictator. Remember the example of Putin riding shirtless on the back of a bear being a symbol of strength in a weird way? Well, President Trump has done the same thing. I wish I were kidding when I tell you this, but on May 4th, the official White House Instagram page posted an AI photo of Donald Trump depicted in Jedi robes. The photo was of him with very veiny muscular arms and a red lightsaber. The caption says, "Happy May the 4th to all, including the radical left lunatics who are fighting so hard to bring Sith lords, murderers, drug lords, dangerous prisoners, and well-known MS-13 gang members back into our galaxy. You are not the rebellion, you're the empire. May the 4th be with you." Did I mention that the photo has Trump with a red lightsaber? Yeah. Another example is Trump's face being photoshopped onto a movie poster.
Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project, big or small. From top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year.
Save big money at Menards.
For the new Superman movie. Let's not even get into the Daddy's Home edits that have plagued my Instagram timeline from the official White House page for the past few weeks. Another example of his large ego is his rallies. I've attended one of his rallies as a reporter in Asheville, North Carolina, on August 14th of 2024. The way the crowd acted was something to behold in person. There was red, white, and blue everywhere. Half of the crowd had the red MAGA hats on, and the event even provided the Trump Vance 2024 signs for the crowd. Every few sentences during Trump's speech, there were pauses for the overwhelming cheers from his supporters. Of course, we've seen the rallies on the news, but to sit through the 3 hours of Trump saying the same 5 things over and over again, along with his supporters chanting Trump in USA every now and again, was agonizing. Trump loves the attention and the fanning. He would even talk with the people in the front rows. Even now that he's in office, he is still hosting rallies to see his supporters. I do not think that these rallies are a way to connect with his constituents, but rather an ego boost for him. Which leads me to him wanting, quote-unquote, his people to sit up at attention when he speaks like the citizens of North Korea do for Kim Jong-un. This comment was said in an impromptu interview with Fox News back in 2018. The clip of the interview resurfaced just last month when the military parade took place in D.C. June 14th. There are different perspectives on what the purpose of this parade was. Some say that it was to celebrate the Army's 250th birthday, and others are saying that it was a parade for Trump's birthday. I lean toward it being for Trump's birthday as of right now. My argument for it being for his birthday and not the Army's hinges on what Trump will do for the other branches' birthdays. Only then will we really see what the purpose of that parade was. But whatever you believe the motive was, the impression of a big ego and need for attention is still present. Dictators are also very paranoid and insecure, even if they give off the impression that they are confident. Trump has surrounded himself with loyalists within the government, including family members, who can be viewed as the most loyal people. In his first term, President Trump appointed his family members to positions within the government. His daughter, Ivanka Trump, and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, were senior advisors for Trump during his first term. At the start of his second term, he appointed the fathers-in-law of two of his daughters as ambassadors. When it comes to members of the cabinet that are unrelated, Trump has only appointed people who agree with him. Yes, appointing people to positions within the government to execute the agenda that the administration has set forth is not unheard of. As a matter of fact, every administration has done this. The difference I'm seeing is that even when people who are relatively qualified for their positions provide information that they've gathered using the governmental research apparatus, including their expertise, Trump does not believe them if it goes against his agenda or his worldview. Recently, with the attacks on Iran, Trump said that he did not believe his Secretary of Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, when she said that Iran did not have nuclear weapons. Trump said, quote, "I don't care what she said. I think they were very close to having one," unquote. In class, we talked about how dictators alienate themselves from their intelligence community when they refuse to believe the facts that are presented to them. They only want to hear information that conforms to their sense of reality. This is part of the co-opting where the ruling elites have an edge over the dictator. The advisory boards are the ones with the information, and they may be holding back information to maintain good graces with the dictator, but that means that they have information that the dictator doesn't. There were questions on if Trump was being briefed every day through the president's daily briefs or if he started only doing weekly briefings. According to a report by Politico, Trump is not having daily PDBs, but is in a constant flow of briefs through advisors. He does attend a weekly brief in person. I'm not implying that this is out of character, as presidents wear many hats and have a lot of things going on at all times. Trump's predecessors, Obama and Bush, had their own style of briefings. Bush preferred daily briefings from the intelligence analysts, and Obama preferred to read the PDB book that is sent out 5 times a week. Difference between Trump and the previous presidents is that Trump does not like reading the book and only has official meetings once a week. I think this could be an opportunity for ruling elites to withhold information potentially. But dictators think that they know everything and that they are the most powerful person within the government. As I mentioned before, the dictators champion executive power. Well, Trump has followed in these footsteps. Besides the Big Beautiful Bill that he signed into law on July 4th, he has used executive orders as a way to try and make big changes within the government. Executive orders are a way to deal with the immediate ramifications of an event. We're talking about tragedies that need to be dealt with very quickly. Natural disasters, attacks against the nation, things of that nature. Congress is meant to be slow and deliberate what they are passing into law. We cannot expect Congress to address immediate disasters, so we leave it up to the executive branch to handle fast-acting events. Trump has taken the power of an executive order to a whole new level. He is using it as a way to bypass Congress altogether. He signed an executive order attempting to dismantle the Department of Education, but he does not have the authority to do so because Congress created the department in 1979 through the passing of the Department of Education Organization Act. Executive orders cannot undo laws passed by Congress. Future Mackenzie jumping in here to add a little bit more context to this example. If there is one thing everyone should know, it is that politics is ever-changing and the information can become outdated very quickly, which is the case for this example about the Department of Education. On July 14th, the Supreme Court handed down an emergency decision on if Trump can start the dismantling of the department. The decision states that Trump can continue with mass layoffs within the department as a way to, quote-unquote, restructure it to make it, quote-unquote, efficient, as long as it continues to operate. This potentially paves the way for Trump to dismantle and end the Department of Education without involving Congress, which could mean a new precedent for executive power. Of course, politics is ever-changing, so I will keep you updated on this through the blog posts, and I'm working on an episode all about the Department of Education. Now back to the episode. Trump is testing this check in power. As of this recording on July 14th, Trump has signed 170 executive orders since he took office at the beginning of the year. 47 of those orders were signed on the first day of his second term. In his first term, he signed 220 executive orders total from 2017 to 2021. In comparison, Biden signed 162 executive orders from 2021 to 2025. Obama, over the course of two terms, from 2009 to 2017, signed 277 executive orders. On average, Obama signed 31 executive orders a year. Trump has signed, on average, 28 executive orders a month. By the end of this year, we are expecting to see roughly 300 executive orders, and by the time the 2028 presidential election rolls around, potentially over 1,000 executive orders. That will put him up there with Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, Herbert Hoover, and FDR. Currently, Wilson has the record for most executive orders passed in one term, with a record of 1,803 executive orders signed. Let's see if Trump takes this as a challenge and tries to surpass that. But you're probably thinking about the checks and balances that are written into our Constitution. The U.S. Constitution sets up three branches of government and separates the powers among the three. With the executive branch having the power to enforce, there is a delicate balance that has been established over the past two centuries with the judicial branch. When the judicial branch says that something is unconstitutional, the executive branch respects that decision. Trump has pushed this balance. Almost all of his executive orders are tied up in court currently, and there are questions on if he will respect the decision the courts make. All court cases involving executive orders are being appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, which could take years to get through. Even if the Supreme Court hands down decisions, there's no guarantee that Trump will follow their decision if it's not in his favor. Another way that dictators bolster the power of the executive branch is by saying they're the only ones to fix the problems people are facing. Trump has campaigned on the slogan, "Drain the swamp," since 2016. Pointing the finger at DC and saying career politicians are the problem is nothing new. Victor L. Berger, the first socialist U.S. representative, is identified as the first to use the swamp metaphor in reference to American capitalism back in 1910. Ronald Reagan adopted this metaphor for conservative rhetoric. He said, quote, "I'm here to drain the swamp of overtaxation, overregulation, and runaway inflation that has dangerously eroded our free way of life," unquote. Trump has continued this rhetoric as a way to make the Democratic Party the enemy of the country. He even has gone as far as to point the finger within the Republican Party at representatives who do not fall in line with his agenda. We can see what happened recently with North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis. He announced that he is not seeking re-election as a senator and is choosing to retire from political life. Chris Cooper, whom you've heard from in some of my previous episodes, wrote an article for Politico talking about the Tillis retirement and how moderate politics is dying. Tillis was in strong opposition to the Big Beautiful Bill over funds for Medicaid being cut. Trump's response to this was to bash Tillis on Truth Social and say that he is, quote, "looking for someone who will properly represent the great people of North Carolina," unquote. Compromise and moderation are no longer an option in Trump's White House. If you oppose his agenda, you become a member of the swamp. But political opposition is not the only group to have Trump's finger pointed at them. Dictators create a sense of terror and break down the communities to garner favor from constituents. The best motivator is fear and anger. Do you remember the clip of Trump saying they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats during the September 10th presidential debate? I do. It ended up remixed on my TikTok For You page and it made me chuckle a little. But that single one-liner caused real consequences for the Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio. Following Trump amplifying the rumors about pets being ate by immigrants, 33 bomb threats were made to the wider community of Springfield, including hospitals, schools, private residents, and businesses, according to a PBS report. Unbased rumors and claims being amplified by Trump isn't anything new. We already touched on immigration in this episode, but I would like to point out that Trump has made Hispanic people, not just immigrants, a target of the people. He says that they're eating pets, they're committing crimes, they're leeches on our society. All random claims to make them a public enemy, even if immigrants contribute billions of dollars to the U.S. economy. Then, Trump sweeps in with mass deportations, saying that he is saving the U.S., that he is making America great again. And if anyone says that what he is doing is bad, or it is hurting the U.S., they become a target too. You know who exposes the flaw in Trump's agenda pretty often? The press. Under autocracies, the press is the first institution that is attacked and put under control. If the government controls the press, they control the message, they control the people. But the takeover of the press doesn't happen overnight. It starts with claims that the media is spreading lies if they report something that goes against the regime. The Nazis called it the lying press. Russia calls it the fire hose of falsehood. In the US, the term is fake news and is used to discredit legitimate reports. Of course, I'm biased about the perception of the press because I'm a journalist. They call the press the fourth estate for a reason. If we aren't there to watch the government, who is? Are we just going to believe everything the government puts out without thinking twice? I previously did an episode about the importance of political journalism if you haven't listened to it. I suggest you go back and listen to it because you hear the reasons why we do what we do and why it's important for democracy. Now, I'm not saying that you should literally believe everything you see on the news. I'm saying to look at it with a healthy skepticism. Know that there is some truth to the news reports, even those from Fox News and CNN with inflammatory language. When the narrative is controlled, that is when democracy can be lost. We as citizens need to be able to understand the whole story and be able to talk about it with our community. Another way that democracy can be lost is through the breakdown of community. When I talk about community, I'm talking about the different people you keep around you. Family members, co-workers, church family, educators, your network of friends. The breakdown of community, the alienation of community, and different perspectives is a side effect of Trump's campaign for polarization. As a society, as communities, we have a difficult time talking about politics. Conversations turn into arguments. Family members no longer talk with each other. We can no longer trust each other. Maybe that's a side effect of US culture being very individualistic, because we only vote for what we want or what will impact us directly, and we don't care about how our vote might impact our community and those around us. The hatred of the opposing side of the aisle is more than hating those in office. Trump has continuously pointed the finger at the radical left as a source of all the problems in the US. This hatred towards elected officials has trickled down into our communities. You can say that you hate someone without knowing it. You could say you hate your friend, your teachers, your parent, even your child. There is no respect or trust or acceptance within our communities anymore, which is where autocracies thrive. Speaking of acceptance, let's talk about accepting election results. If you're guessing where I'm going with this, you'd be correct if you guessed I'd be talking about the January 6th insurrection. Schmitter and Carl talked about how parties within a democratic governing system will accept the results of the election and the fact that the winners have the ability to make binding decisions for the country. There are many cases of emerging dictators not accepting the results of an election and stopping the transfer of power. That is how dictators cement themselves as such. People still to this day refuse to believe that Joe Biden won the 2020 election, all because Trump said that there was mass election fraud. I did an episode about the NC Supreme Court election dispute a few months ago, and at the end, I talked about how election fraud is very unlikely. I also did a case study about election security where I talked with Amanda Allen, the director of the Jackson County Board of Elections, about the processes local boards of election go through to ensure security of elections. I quite literally spent the fall 2024 semester covering election security in my county. When I tell you the odds of mass election fraud occurring are slim to none, I mean it. But no matter how much we scream it from the mountaintops, people are still going to believe that the 2020 election was rigged. These claims sparked and incited the January 6th insurrection. Trump supporters refused to believe the election results because Trump said it was rigged, and they still believe it to this day. Dictators are always seeking more power and more assets. Trump is acting like a dictator through wanting more territory. Dictators are imperialist by nature. They want to expand the power of their regime to as many people and as places as possible. Nazi Germany was constantly annexing regions to expand their empire. The USSR was the same way, and Putin invading Ukraine in 2022 can be seen as an imperial claim. So when Trump says that he wants to make Canada the 51st state, or that he wants to take over Greenland, or that he wants control over the Panama Canal again, or when he renames the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America, I can't help but see some imperial tendencies. But you can't get all of that done within 4 years. That's why presidents tend to run for a second term. The limit currently is that Trump is in his second term, but that hasn't stopped him. Trump has signaled that he wants to run for a third term, even though it is not allowed by our Constitution. The two-term limit was not an official rule in our Constitution until FDR died in office after winning a fourth term. Prior to that, it was just a custom that was established by George Washington because he did not want to be a king. But that does not matter. Trump wants another term. People I've talked to about this are just brushing it off as a joke. Others are saying that there are loopholes that Trump can use so that he isn't violating the Constitution. We've talked about a lot of things so far. But do I think that Trump will become a dictator? My answer is no. A few reasons and a lot of hope to back this opinion. To start off, I do not think that Trump did a good job at co-opting the elites. He has made many enemies, one prevalent one being Elon Musk. Now, I do not care for Musk, but I will say, him making a public display of him cutting ties with Trump over the Big Beautiful Bill, I think that signals that many other elites may not be happy with this bill, and the side effects that may last years or decades. He also owes to many people. There are reports about how much money he owes to cities around the country for his campaigns. Let's not even try and get into campaign donations and favors he owes and has not been able to fulfill. The ruling elites may not be backing everything he is doing and will prevent him from running for a third term or circumventing the Constitution to get back into office. My hopeful reasoning is that the people won't stand for it. June 14th wasn't just the day of Trump's birthday parade. It was also the day that people took to the streets and said no kings. It is reported that anywhere from 5 million to 7 million people across the world, not just the country, but the world, took to the streets to protest Trump's administration. 2,000 locations across the country had people come out in droves. Protests were taking up miles and miles in large cities. Whole city blocks were filled with people. As a country, we said no. Normally, large-scale protests have a singular motive for protesting. Back in 2020, the Black Lives Matter protests were bringing attention and protesting police brutality. Not the No Kings protests. There were so many things people were protesting. Immigration policy, executive power overreach, abortion rights, government funds being cut from welfare programs, and so many other things. Literally anything that Trump has done, it was being protested. Trump may have won the 2024 election, but I think people are now coming to their senses about what a second Trump term means and are pushing back. I do not think that people will allow him to become a dictator, and this gives me hope. I have hopes that our democracy will prevail, but our democracy is not invincible. We have to be able to identify traits of autocracies and be able to understand when we are backsliding as a democracy. Europeans are looking at the US with confusion. They're like, can you not see what's happening right in front of you? According to a survey commissioned by Le Grand Continent and Cluster 17, 39% of polled Europeans think that Trump acts like a dictator. If people who have experienced autocracy in one shape or another are able to pick it out in our own country, we should be worried. With the 4th of July being at the beginning of this month, some were saying that those who weren't celebrating don't love the U.S. and aren't good Americans. Those who weren't celebrating don't hate the U.S. As a matter of fact, they love America, and they are mourning what is happening to her. To mourn is to love, and that is more patriotic than dressing up in red, white, and blue and watching fireworks. Self-reflection is the best thing that we can do. But do not stop fighting the good fight against tyranny. Our democracy has not failed us yet. Do not let it fail us now. Thank you for tuning into That's Politics, where I broke down the differences between autocracies and democracies, as well as talked about democratic backsliding in the U.S. To view the source material used for this episode, visit the website at thatspoliticspodcast.com. Come back next time, where I'm going to attempt to break down the big, beautiful bill for you. I'm Mackenzie Atkinson, and I'll see you next time.